So one of the many areas of medicine that we've had to become more acquainted with over the last month or so has been the concept of personal protective equipment, or PPE. We've had to refresh our skills in donning the said equipment, as well as keeping abreast of the many updates about when we should be wearing it, all the whilst being mindful about the possibility that it might run out. So I thought it would be useful for us to talk with our colleagues in the paramedicine world, of whom PPE for a wide range of potential hazards is something that they must maintain up-to-date skills and be prepared for. So I'm interested to hear how they are addressing the current need for personal protective equipment in the world of COVID-19, and also in particular, I'm keen to hear how they're assessing and mitigating their risks, given that they don't have the luxury of isolated rooms. So to answer my queries, I'm joined today by Aaron Turner. Aaron is an intensive care paramedic with St John's here in New Zealand, based down in Christchurch on the South Island. He facilitates the STEMI pathway for Canterbury, and he's also one of the HAZMAT specialists for St John's, so he's a perfect person to talk to in this regard. So I'd like to welcome you to the podcast, Aaron.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here.
So if we start with the current situation, obviously the world's facing with COVID-19, how is it that paramedics are managing to keep themselves and also their patients safe during this time? How are you going about that?
It's an interesting concept. At the moment, it's quite a surreal feeling that all of the information we're receiving from overseas, from a range of our colleagues, is not necessarily representative of how we're currently going about our process here in New Zealand. And saying that, we're extremely aware of the risks associated with the COVID virus, and the fact that we deal with a large range of high at-risk populations in our day-to-day lives. That, and amongst our sort of austere environments that we work in, and the fact that we're entering environments that we're unaware of, or a range of patients who may not necessarily be aware of our intent, makes the application of PPE quite important and quite hard sometimes to navigate. We've got quite a range of PPE options, however, in the due to the constantly changing data that I'm sure anyone in the medical field is aware of, with the almost daily, hourly releases of protocol changes and all the rest. We start the morning every day by having a quick look at our protocols just to see if they have changed. But our standard protocols are just like everybody else around the country with regards to droplet protection. So we're at the moment wearing surgical masks at all times during our shift, so our shifts are 12 hours in length, and only taking those off for breaks. Now, there's a little bit of not necessarily strict adherence to that, just for comfort reasons, but at no point do we put ourselves at risk. We're always wearing them around patients, around our colleagues, and around hospital. If we're then looking at addressing a patient who does have a potential COVID risk, we're then escalating further through to the N95 mask. At this stage, our stocks are really nice and secure. We've got transportive stocks around the country from our logistics headquarters. So we're relatively comfortable with our PPE levels, and therefore encouraging all staff to actually utilise them where appropriate. So that's kind of where we're at this stage. We do have, as part of our standard protection, we have our gowns, our overalls, and that sort of forms what we class as our level one step of contamination. And through the HAZMAT protocols, we've got around five levels that are associated with that and fall in line with FENS. And we can talk a bit more about that shortly.
So when you're going to attend a patient, how does the process of assessing the risk start? Is it presumably when somebody's made a phone call to 111 with that they're providing details of what the problem is? So, but it may be somebody's fallen and broken their ankle, but they might also have a respiratory illness at the same time. So how along these lines are you kind of gathering the information to know when you get out of your ambulance, what is the situation that you're facing?
So our comms team are doing a great job at the moment. They're have a range of questions that they must follow through for every job to gain all of the information that then comes down our mobile data terminal in our ambulance and provides us with any sort of changes on the scene or any details about what we're actually responding to. What's happened post the emergence of COVID has been a slight adjustment to the questions. So we do have questions specifically orientated towards the emergent disease, so shortness of breath. There used to be a temperature check in there, I think, but with the change in protocols, that's not currently there. But there's also questions with regards to general flu-like symptoms or any exposure potential to overseas travel historically or anyone who's currently going through the process of being tested or being proven to be positive. So that's sort of happening in the background. And what comes down our data terminal is all of that information that's relevant to us at the time. When we turn up to the address, we're still wearing our surgical masks. And we're now currently undertaking a stop 2 meters from the address once the door's been opened and we can engage with anyone on scene and asking them the questions ourselves. So the questions might go along the lines of, has anyone in your house or anyone you've been directly in contact with through your bubble been overseas recently, such as the last 3 to 4 weeks? Has anyone been tested for, or has anyone been in contact with someone who has COVID? Or along the lines of, has anyone in this house expressed symptoms of fever, cough, runny nose, any generalized chest infection? If that at that point the patient or the family members say no to those points, we will progress into the address. Still keeping an open mind that things do change. We have had people mislead us in an effort to allow them to be treated in a manner that they deem appropriate. They think that if they tell us that they have any of these risk factors, we will withhold treatment or we will treat them differently, which can be very frustrating and it puts our staff at risk.
So when you're arriving at somebody's house, for example, the environment within the house is a bit of an unknown. Even as you say, some people are giving you slightly misleading information. So going into somebody's house in the past, you might have treated people within kind of on the site more. Are you finding now that you're maybe scooping and running a little bit more to get out of that environment, or are you donning on the sort of the full gear and remaining at the scene? Has it sort of changed your practice on site once you're actually with the patient?
It depends on the patient's initial presentation and what's actually developing. If the environment changes and we actually learn more information that there is a potential for a COVID exposure, we then withdraw from the address and put on the appropriate PPE, and then we'll re-enter and then reassess the situation. We're under strict protocols now where it's very similar to ED or any emergency GP centres in the fact that no aerosols are to be undertaken. We're under strict protocols where only for status 1 patients may we initialise a nebuliser. That's been slightly relaxed and is more appropriate now, but as we're entering flu season with a sharp rise in COPD presentations, it's going to get quite frustrating from our perspective, where we can't necessarily treat a patient effectively on scene and therefore have to transport the environment in an isolation room. It's going to be interesting to see how that goes moving forward. It hasn't meant that we necessarily walk into an address, see a patient that there is a risk, and remove them to our ambulance. Because as soon as we bring that patient out of their home environment into the ambulance environment, we then potentially contaminate our ambulance. And we want to reduce our turnaround time as much as possible. So by keeping them in their own personal bubble as such, it allows us to treat them there. We're protected by our own PPE. And although there's been recent news, I think today, with regards to a nurse who was wearing PPE, still gaining COVID, the protections that we put in place for ourselves are, in my opinion, very high if they're strictly followed. So our risk is actually relatively minimal.
And you mentioned there that you don't want them contaminating the ambulance, but presumably if somebody's sick enough that they get into the ambulance, you take them to hospital. What's your procedures then? Is your ambulance offline for a period of time? What's the cleanup now compared to previous?
We're very lucky in Christchurch, especially. We run what we call a hub and spoke model, where all our ambulances start at a central location, and every ambulance is cleaned top to toe after every 12-hour shift. So our levels of hygiene to start the day are fantastic. Now, around the country, that's up to the crews to undertake, and they do a fantastic job, but it can be slightly unreliable sometimes. What happens at the moment with regards to the decontamination of an ambulance once we arrive at hospital is the fact that the ambulance is completely aired while the patient is taken in through the ED, through to the isolation rooms, and we're directed by the hospital staff with regards to where we're going for that. And then the ambulance is just wiped down. With the fact that the doors and everything is open for a period of time and the vehicle is aired, the COVID is not necessarily to the point of being fully aerosolized. So we allow it to settle, and then all surfaces where the patient has had potential to come in contact with, such as our monitoring equipment, the stretcher or the area around the stretcher, is completely wiped down with disinfectant wipes and allowed to dry. And that's been shown to be quite effective.
And then you're back on the road again. And it may be that an urgent care clinic, such as the ones I work in, might have somebody acutely unwell who turns up. We're trying our best to keep our waiting rooms empty and direct people to the appropriate places. So hopefully we're not getting as much of the acute respiratory illnesses coming to our clinics. But if they are and they're sick enough, we might have to call an ambulance to transport them to hospital. So when we're calling, now you've mentioned how your call centres have further questions, which whoever's calling the ambulance will have to be answering appropriately. In terms of when you guys arrive, how should that interface work when you appear? Let's say we've got a febrile respiratory patient with the sort of the suspect of COVID is certainly there. So how should this interface happen when you guys arrive?
I guess it doesn't change from anything we've actually undertaken in the past. We often have certain entrances that we'll approach a GP or an urgent care facility through. And once we undertake that, we're usually directed. And the patient's quite often in what we term the resource room. And, you know, a simple handover, as long as it's portrayed via the phone that this patient is being treated as a potential COVID risk, means that we'll turn up in the appropriate PPE and we'll enter the facility in that PPE. So as long as the information is present at the time of phone call, there's no concerns. The issues arise when obviously there's been a breakdown in communication from our end or the urgent care end, and not all that information gets through. Or in some cases where the patient may not actually require interventions on the way to hospital, and it's essentially just being used as a transport option, and that then potentially contaminates and risks exposure to other staff members. Generally, that doesn't happen, but the majority of the time when we deal with urgent care facilities, it's absolutely fantastic, and they work really well with us.
So it's, as with anything, it's communication up front. And as I say, it may be that somebody's rolled an ankle and has a nasty fracture they need to go and see the orthopaedic surgeon for. But if they've had a respiratory illness that could be somebody with a not too clinically significant kind of COVID, you know, that they'd have just waited out at home, you need to know that. So we need to be communicating at this time as clearly as possible. What have you guys been finding? Because certainly from our perspective, there's been a real change since lockdown in terms of presentations and the volume of patients that we've been seeing, which is slightly counter to what we're seeing from our colleagues around the world and makes us feel a little bit awkward in that we've not really been hit as hard, which we're very grateful for. Have you noticed a similar change in your workload at the moment, and or are you seeing more of certain things and less of other things at this point?
So what we're seeing at the moment is definitely in line with what the rest of the country is seeing from a medical perspective, and that our workload has dropped slightly. Now, the workload that we are seeing is appropriate, and people are calling us. Now, what we're seeing drop off is those inappropriate calls for the stub toe or the fact that they may have cut their finger on a bit of paper. So those sort of calls are dropping off, which is fantastic. And the calls that we're getting are the ones that are actually very appropriate, and the patients generally do need us. The impact overseas that we've seen is, especially from the London data, is that sharp rises occurred, and a lot of misinformation has resulted with the public in calling the ambulance service for COVID screening. We're very lucky here with a very clear message from the government stating that we have certain community areas which are undertaking COVID screening, and their emergency services are purely for emergencies only. And that's been a great relief from our perspective. Along the lines of the workload that we are seeing beyond the people that do present on a sort of an accident basis, we've seen a marked drop from my own personal experiences in Christchurch of the likes of your car crashes or your car be pedestrian, your cyclists. So all of those extracurricular activities have absolutely plummeted. We've had a slight rise within our mental health and anxiety cases. And this is only data that I've seen from my experiences in Christchurch. I'm unsure around the country. But also along the lines of our what we term patient management plans. So the people that call us on a relatively frequent basis and have a condition that's relatively predictable, that have a very clear management plan in place. And often there's a mental health component or an addiction component associated with that. We've had a slight increase in a number of those presentations, but it may have just been my exposure on one of my last night shifts where I had four in a row, so I could be a little biased on that.
And with respect to things like resus situations, we've had new guidelines about how to resus in the COVID world now. You guys will obviously see a much higher frequency of these sorts of emergency life-threatening situations. So has that changed significantly for you guys when you get that kind of 111 priority call? Has that changed things significantly for you?
We're still instructed to undertake our stop at 2 meters from the address, regardless of the priority of the patient. So our first priority is to protect ourselves and ensure that we aren't getting any potential risk of exposure. The requirements for that is that all cardiac arrests mean that we upgrade to an N95 mask and are wearing glasses throughout the arrest, which is not the most comfortable thing. However, if you're then managing an airway on top of that, you must have full droplet protection, so you're wearing a gown as well. There's been a complete de-emphasis of endotracheal intubation. So if at all it's an LMA, of course with a filter placed on top, and no bag masking is to occur without that confirmed airway via an LMA. The whole point is to reduce aerosolization of any particles whatsoever. So as soon as even that LMA is in place, we're placing a towel over the airway just to ensure that the risk is reduced to an absolute minimum. We have to kind of think here for a moment that what we run at a cardiac arrest is a minimum of two ambulances, and that's an ambulance with two people on it and a Jeep with one intensive care paramedic, or it may be two full ambulances. So a range of 3 to 4 ambulance staff, and then FENS, or the fire service, is also dispatched as well. So it's a minimum of 4 firemen or firewomen. So the scene grows exponentially, and we can have a range of 6 to 8 people. So managing the risk of all of those individuals is quite paramount as well. So reducing the number of people in direct exposure to the room or the patient, and then making sure that they're all wearing the appropriate PPE at the time. There was some interesting data or an interesting discussion document that came out or was leaked to the media with regards to the fact that St. John were not undertaking CPR or undertaking resuscitation of COVID patients. That's not true. What we undertake is actually what we do for all cardiac arrests pre-COVID as well, is we take an understanding of the good and bad prognosis factors and then decide if resus is actually warranted for this patient. If the patient has had an unwitnessed arrest and wasn't seen 4 hours ago, it doesn't necessarily mean that the asystole that we see in front of us is actually going to lead to a good prognosis. Actually, it's not. And what Joe Public often see is that a person has collapsed, you're not actually undertaking resuscitation with actually by not understanding the clinical components that are being discussed in the background.
Yeah, so it's a change of it's just a looking at things in a slightly different light, but the principles remain the same. It's that doctor's ABC. The very first D is for danger, and you've got to make sure that you're safe. So you've got to stop and consider the situation and weigh the risks and everything. And that goes on regardless, like you say, of a pandemic. But it just changes. It changes things a little bit, and we've all got to keep a speed with the various different guidelines. And my experience has been, across the board, the guidelines have been very clear and easy to follow and updated regularly for all sorts of areas of life at the moment. So, the resus is just another one of those. But you are still resuscitating people. I think that's probably a key message to get across there.
Absolutely. There's a range of factors that we discuss and look at for any cardiac arrest. Unfortunately, if we turn up to these situations, we do not necessarily know if the patient is COVID positive or negative. They're not able to tell us. So although it forms in the poor prognosis category, it's still quite an unknown. So if that's the case and the patient is presenting with good prognosis factors, they will be resuscitated. There's no level of bias here whatsoever, because, to be honest, we don't know half the time.
Hmm. And that's one of the reasons I was interested in talking to you guys about this, because it's a, as I said at the beginning, we've had to suddenly become familiar with PPE, and the whole of the clinic has been kind of reshuffled because of COVID-19. But the truth is that paramedics on a daily basis are going off into the unknown and being called to situations which are incredibly unpredictable, potentially dangerous, and could have a lot of significant hazards from chemicals to you name it. And I mentioned that you were one of the hazmat specialists down in Christchurch. So what's outside of the COVID bubble, what other kind of hazmat precautions are you guys keeping upskilled in the rare case, you know, sometimes the very rare occasions that something might happen?
So we have a range of equipment available to us. I've mentioned the levers of protection earlier in the podcast. So just like everyone else at the moment, we carry gowns and our N95 masks as our base level. We then have an intermediate level, which has a specifically wax-covered overalls with longer gloves, boots, and a face shield. So a lot of the media coming from overseas is that you see doctors or nurses or healthcare professionals wearing that level, and that's that sort of intermediate level, next step up for what New Zealand is currently utilising. Where hazmat comes into its own really is the next two levels. And that is where there's potential risk to a more lethal substance, such as Ebola in the biological realm, or whether or not you're looking at the chemical or the radiological component. We have a level C or level 3, which allows us to have a Saratoga suit. And that's a specifically designed suit which has multiple layers and a carbon lining to reduce our exposure to any radioactive substances, primarily alpha particles. And associated with that is specific gloves and also a full face respirator. Now, that is a military grade respirator that has a certain filter on it, and that is designed to filter any particles that enter that for a period of time. Now, that ranges, if it's a particularly acidic particle, it may have a shorter shelf life than the likes of a biological. And that full face mask is only for our hazmat team. The next level up is then when we're working with FENS, and this is, we take their lead in this environment. This is their specialty, and we're here to help facilitate any medical component associated with that. So the next level of protection is their bright orange splash suits. So that's a full chemical splash exposure suit, which allows the individual inside to be completely isolated from any exposure. And associated with wearing that, all hazmat members are trained in self-contained breathing apparatus, and that's all through the fens. Quite often what you see overseas is a full level 4 containment, which is the gas isolation suits, and they sort of like look like bubble people walking around. That is only fens specific, so medics through St. John are not trained to that level.
It's fascinating because, as I mentioned, we're not that significantly hit by COVID compared to some of the other countries around the world at the moment, and in part that's due to a good response, I think, here in New Zealand, and we're relatively isolated and the like. But New Zealand has sadly in the last few years been hit with a few occasions where the St. John team have had to demonstrate this. Going forwards where others would normally be running away. We had it recently with the White Island eruption, and then sadly down in your neck of the woods, the shootings and the earthquakes. So you're always prepared for these sorts of situations, these moments where you've got to put yourself at risk, albeit mitigating it by wearing the levels of protective equipment that you've mentioned there, and working with the other emergency services. So in some respects, COVID is just another one of those occasions where you've just got to keep going forwards to do your job. And I think certainly the our urgent care community, and I think the rest of New Zealand, are very grateful that you guys are there to do that. And my hat is very much off in your direction, because it's a very special thing that you do. So thank you, Aaron, for telling us about your perspective of this COVID-19. Would you like to just tell me a little bit before you go about, you've been very kind to include our podcast in one of your foam monthly updates that you put out for St. John, because you're in charge of doing that. Can you collate a lot of free open access medical education from around the world, and you put it together in a document that people can then use, particularly relevant to people who work in ED and some of the more kind of acute ends of the spectrum. Can you just tell us a little bit about that before you go?
Absolutely. I took the lead from Hayden Drake, who I think you've also heard on your podcast earlier last year, I think. He's an ICP in Auckland and a lecturer through AUT. And he started the publication monthly a couple of years ago, and it fell off the grid just due to his other commitments. I got bored after I completed my intensive care paramedic training, and it seems to be a habit of mine that I then pick something up. And if I'm learning, I might as well help other people learn as well. So hence, I started back up along with a couple of other paramedics, a sort of a collaborative effort that every month we put out a document. And all it is a bit of food for thought, allows people to sort of, if they're driving to work or out walking the dog, for them to put on a podcast and sort of just listen to anything in the background. So that's essentially what I do in my spare time. Put that out monthly and allows other people just to get a tidbit for any sort of tips, tricks, or current trends that they're seeing overseas. And currently with all of the COVID podcasts coming out, it makes for interesting listening.
Hmm. And people can find that. You normally tweet out the link. So your Twitter handle, if people wanted to find you, how would they find you on Twitter?
Oh, geez, you're pushing me here. I think it's Aaron TUNZ. But it's also published through Wellington Free. It's published through St. John, through our internal email system. And I'll confirm that Twitter handle with you, Guy. But
I'll tweet your handle when we put this podcast out as well, so people can follow you and get that, because it's really useful when somebody goes to the effort to collate all this free. Open access medical education from around the world and put it in one place, and it makes our ongoing CME and education, as you say, it just helps keep that brain active and interested. So So it's another great thing that you do. So thank you for talking to us today, Aaron. I wish you all the best. Keep safe and keep doing what you're doing.
Fantastic. Thank you.